Welcome to episode 6 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. I'm the formerly incarcerated one. Among other things, I'm currently a freelance writer, a criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book, Writing Your Own Story, Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Joel?
Hi there. I'm Joel Barson, and I'm Josh's squire.
I still don't know how to respond to that. I don't know what even that means.
We should just move on then.
All right. Well, I want to start out with a shout out to A Brighter Way, which is a Michigan organization providing mentorship for people coming home from prison. They had a benefit in Ann Arbor last night. It was just an amazing time. I know some of your friends were there too, Joel. We had a full house. There were about 10 musical artists performing, and most important, several recently released formerly incarcerated folks who had been mentored by A Brighter Way spoke about how important mentorship and hope are to people who are incarcerated. It was really powerful.
Thanks for being there, Josh. It's excellent.
Yeah, and I just wanted to, like I said, it's a shout out. My friend Aaron Suganuma started that organization. We're both active in a couple other organizations together, including Nation Outside, which we've talked about before.
Yeah,
So really good time, really powerful testimony from some really good guys who just got out. So today we're recording two closely related episodes. The first one, we've been slowly working our way through the criminal justice process from the very beginning. We've been talking about why prisons don't reduce safety, carve-outs in legislation, prosecutorial discretion, and we just did one on bail. And now we're talking about the pre-sentencing period, which includes plea bargaining, which is the episode we're recording right now. So what did you learn about plea bargaining this week, Joel?
Well, like you and I were just chatting about moments before we started recording, my preparation for this episode, once again, sort of helped to clear away the fog of my own misunderstanding or my own mythology of how the criminal justice system actually works. Specifically, I think I largely believed that the criminal justice system is about trials, that it happens in courts, that's what our criminal justice system looks like. But in preparation,
this is, I assume, from like television and movies,
from all those things. I mean, you know, it that's where it all takes place. The drama is in the courtroom. It all, you know, when we learn about our triune form of government, we learn that the third branch is the judicial branch, the courts. And you know, I the reading that we did in preparation was incredibly enlightening in that. That's not where justice is carried out in this country, not even by a long shot.
Yeah, here's a quote I found on that from District Judge Jed S. Rakoff, who suggested that the drama inherent in the Constitution is regularly portrayed in movies and television as an open battle played out in public before a judge and jury. But this is all a mirage. In actuality, our criminal justice system is almost exclusively a system of plea bargaining, negotiated behind closed doors with no judicial oversight. The outcome is very largely determined by the prosecutor alone.
Yeah, you know, we read an article from The Atlantic in May of 2017 that has the statistic that 97% of federal cases are settled by plea bargain, 97%. And from an article in the Nevada Law Journal, taken including state and other courts, it's 90% of all cases end in plea bargain.
Yeah, and you know that varies from year to year, but I've seen that most say it's above 95% on both the federal and state level.
So that's where quote-unquote justice is really happening. And if I could bring in a pop culture reference real fast, in my mind as I was reading through this was the movie A Few Good Men. I was thinking of the character played by Tom Cruise, where he is, we're led to understand at the beginning, a brilliant lawyer who works for the Judge Advocate General Corps in the Navy, I think. And he does this negotiation with a prosecutor while he's playing baseball, and we come away seeing his brilliance and his agility and seemingly getting justice and deference for his client all through that plea bargaining process. But it comes out during the movie that he has never tried a case, and Demi Moore encourages him to try the case that becomes the crux of the movie, because she feels that the defendants in the movie would not have justice served without a true trial.
Yeah, and another district court judge, John Kane of Colorado, put it like this: if there is no trial, there can be no fair trial, and that means that the constitutional right, for most part, is a myth. Which is a pretty strong statement about when you think that virtually every case doesn't go to trial.
Yeah, I mean, given that that is so, that all of this happens between attorneys in a plea bargaining context, you begin to realize that the infrastructure of our system doesn't even have the capacity to handle all the trials that would be necessary if our system functioned as it currently does.
Yeah, so see, the problem started basically in the 80s and the 90s when we started doing the tough on crime that we've talked about a lot. And, you know, while it sounds like tough on crime means tough on reducing crime, most people interpret that to mean tough on criminals. And so what's happened is we've had, you know, 30 years of legislation that's designed to increase the amount of people who are prosecuted and the amount of people who are put in through incarceration, which is why we have the mass incarceration problem we have now. And in order to accommodate the gigantic increase in the amount of people being processed through the system, it became necessary to start having less trials. And that's become so extreme now. As we said, very few cases ever go to trial. And so the way I look at plea bargaining, it's kind of like a shotgun wedding. No matter what you did to get yourself to the altar of marriage or justice, the end result probably isn't just. If that's, you know, so a lot of people probably don't understand why plea bargaining is so problematic beyond just the existence of most cases not going to trial.
Give us a primer.
Okay. So first, as we've mentioned before, legislators pass a lot of bills defining the criminal code. Unfortunately, in the last 30 years, they've started to pass overlapping bills. Bills that create overlapping criminal penalties. And so you could be charged for a million different things, even if you've only committed, you know, you committed one crime, but a million different things were covered in that particular crime. And this is done on purpose because the code works to create the leverage in the plea bargaining system. So for instance, if you robbed a bank, you could be charged for bank robbery, for threatening with a deadly weapon, for possessing a deadly weapon, for illegal use of a firearm, for threatening bodily harm, for, you know, there's a million other examples of this, but that's how it works. And so when you get arrested for a crime like that, then you kind of are sitting in the, you know, you eventually meet your lawyer, and they show you what the charges are. And that charging document determines how you look at your crime. And so you see this crazy list of all the things you're being charged with, and each of those charges carries an independent sentence. So like if you got charged with, you know, like I said, threatening with a deadly weapon, that could be 10 to 20 years. Then you have possession of a deadly weapon, that'll be 5 to 10 years. Then you have illegal use of a firearm, that's probably 10 to 20 years. So you add all those up, and that's the sentence you're facing if you take all of the charges. So the prosecutor comes in all nice, you know, they've given you this charging document, and they tell you basically, you know, right now you're facing a charging document that'll put you in jail for like 100 years, you know, but we'll offer you a deal, and that deal will mean that you ultimately do about 8 years, but you have to agree to a bunch of conditions, and you have to plead guilty to a bunch of things. And in the end, that'll make the rest of this go away. But here's the kicker. If you turn down this deal, we're going to take you to trial and charge you with everything on that charging document. And we're going to push to get the maximum sentence on every single one of those charges. And so that's the best possible example of how a plea bargain can go down. It gets much worse than that. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But in a perfect world, that's what a plea bargaining deal looks like.
So let me stop you there and peel that back a tiny bit, and I don't want to jump ahead too much in our conversation, but one of the remedies that is sometimes suggested for the over-reliance of plea bargains for adjudicating criminal consequences is more trials. And I guess my question for you, Josh, if it's understood that this is what's happening, and presumably defense attorneys are wise to this dynamic, to what the Atlantic article calls the inordinate leverage that prosecutors have, then why wouldn't defense attorneys sort of flip that script and tell their clients, we should go to trial because the prosecutor is using bluster and threats and is attempting to scare you, and trials, in the words of another one of the articles we read, are an audit on this process. Why wouldn't people go to trial, and isn't that what's being suggested as a remedy anyway?
In a weird kind of way, you answered your own question. When we first started this discussion, you said our system is a trial system, or that's what you thought for most of your life.
Right.
And in all those cases that you watched, in all those movies and television, how many people were found not guilty?
Right. Yeah, hardly any, although in A Few Good Men.
Sure, there are times, but they weren't found. They weren't found not guilty in A Few Good Men. They were found guilty of different, not all of the crimes.
That's right. That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
And so what happens actually in most of the cases of all those television and movies is when someone gets off, it's seen as a failure of the system. And we talked about this during the prosecutor's episode. Most of those shows start from the premise that the real reason why there isn't justice in the United States is because civil rights protect defendants. And so the end result is most people who've been through the system even once, and this includes me, are highly cynical about the possibilities of justice. And so if you're facing a charging document that gives you 100 years and the prosecutor has said they're going to take you to trial, and try to get the maximum on every one of those charges, that's pretty terrifying, because not only do you know you're probably, if you have a jury trial, facing a jury that has spent most of their life watching Law and Order and The Closer and every other show that the basic point is you should never be lenient or you should never find anyone not guilty, they know that most people they've seen go through the system always lose those cases.
So are you saying that it is it's a conditioned barrier? It's sort of a cultural or
well, part of it's just the deal itself. Yeah. You know, if you already are very cynical about the possibilities of justice happening, and you're facing a choice between, you know, say 8 years and 108 years, you know, and you already think there's very little chance that you're going to win, not necessarily just because of guilt, but because of how the system works, then you're probably going to be less likely to, you're going to be likely to take the plea.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. Maybe to sort of button up that topic, I want to note that Michelle Alexander, who many might know is the author of The New Jim Crow, has said that if everybody refused to take the deal, that they would force every case into the courts, and they would thereby crash the courts as a form of resistance to mass incarceration, which seems like a novel way of sort of getting the attention of the system, but probably not a likely one.
Yeah, there's two problems with that. The first is that everybody who turned down their plea would then be facing ultimately that charge that we talked about before. And you're right, it would probably shut down the court system. But for all the people in jail who didn't get bail, what does that mean? It means they're stuck in jail until their trial date. So, you know, the incentive for people to do it, on the one hand, yes, it is actually correct that if everybody turned down their plea, the court system would literally almost cease as we know it. They just don't have the resources, the courts or the judges, to handle all those cases.
Which would mean, just to underline what you just said, there would be people would be spending exorbitant amounts of time waiting for their day in court in violation of their constitutional
rights. Well, in a world in which there were no plea bargains, they would be spending years and years and years and years, sometimes multiple years, just to get a court date, much less have their case go to court. And yeah. So that symbolic action, there would be a heavy penalty for the people who participated in that. Doesn't mean that she's wrong. She's definitely right. It would shut down the system. Now, I think one thing that most people listening might think immediately is, okay, so what? You know, if these people are guilty, you know, who really cares? And I think there's kind of two ways that we need to talk about that. The first one is, are there innocent people who plead guilty? And I think the evidence has overwhelmingly shown that that's true, that there are people who take a plea who probably were innocent of what they were charged with. So how would this happen? Well, I think the first one is fear, and we've talked about that before, is that in the face of the charging document and the power of the prosecutor and the cynicism about law, that a lot of people just decide, you know, this is the best alternative, you know, and that's kind of depressing. There's also, as we talked about, I think during the bail episode, if the plea bargain involves not having jail time, but pleading guilty to say a felony or a misdemeanor, or say, you might take that because jail is a very brutal place. And so in a lot of times, the time you're waiting for your trial and for the plea bargain to resolve, you might get attacked, or you might get extorted, or you might get sexually abused, or any number of things. And that might make you want to plead guilty.
No doubt.
I mean, and take the plea bargain. There's some other examples. Prosecutors have really wide discretion in constructing pleas. The only restriction that they have is that they can't threaten you with anything illegal. And so, like, they couldn't say, you take this plea or I'll shoot you. But they can pretty much do almost anything else. One example of that is, say that the crime you were involved with, your wife or loved one or a family member was either also involved with or could have been charged. So if a prosecutor tells you, if you take the plea, we won't prosecute your friend, lover, or family member, that's a pretty big incentive to take the plea, even
sure.
if perhaps you're not yeah. guilty.
Yeah. And am I right that the counter argument that a prosecutor might give is that that kind of latitude and that kind of creativity and even fungibility of guilt and punishment is, they might say, it's necessary in some cases, such as organized crime prosecutions.
I think this is a baby with the bathwater thing. You know, the problem is that these rules like RICO and things like that were created, or, you know, what's the one where they take your property as if your property had committed a crime that everyone talks about?
Right. Yeah.
All of these things were created to conduct prosecutions against organized crime, but then have been used against everybody else with impunity
right.
in ways that they were never intended for.
Right.
And the end result isn't really justice. It's more just kind of wholesale mass incarceration.
And to your point that an innocent person might understandably plead guilty to get...
Well, think about property.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, this is an example. Say the plea bargain allows me to escape jail time,
mm-hmm.
but the way that it was I was threatened was by the plea bargain was, if you accept the plea bargain, we won't try to confiscate your property. You know, there's examples of cases where parents, like, say, for instance, your kid gets nabbed in a drug heist,
mm-hmm.
and they have reason to believe that the house that you own, at some point the drugs were in that house. Theoretically, and this has actually happened, they could confiscate your house as part of a drug thing. So if the plea bargain, for instance, was, we won't try to take your house, you know, if you plead
right.
guilty, but don't. So you see how this can
right.
become pretty ridiculous.
It's like that inordinate leverage, to use language from that article in The Atlantic, that the prosecutor has can encompass virtually every area of your life, everything you care about.
Yeah, and they know that, and they're, again, because their incentive structure is set up to reward convictions, they care much more about that than they do. And, you know, but let's do what we've been doing in every episode, and let's forget about innocence. Okay. Because to a very small percentage of, even in this literature, of people are innocent who plea bargain.
Right.
But the, again, the question is, innocent of what?
Right.
You know, one of the reasons why a guilty person will accept, you know, just like anything else, you might be a guilty of some of the charges on your charging sheet and not guilty of other ones. And you end up pleading to things that you're not guilty of just so that you don't face. And think about, this is a particularly Faustian bargain. So say I'm guilty of some of the things on my charging sheet, but not all of them. But when I'm at trial, the fact that I'm guilty of some of them is going to prejudice people to believe that I'm guilty of everything else.
Right.
So there is a huge incentive for me to participate in the plea bargain, even if I'm pleading to things that I wasn't guilty of. And there, that's important. Like, to say I am guilty of some things but not guilty of all these other things, there is something important about that. You should only have to do time for the things you're actually guilty of. And I think a prosecutor might say, well, if that's true, you should take it to trial.
Right.
But again, that's kind of a loaded bargain, as I just explained. You know, if you are, there isn't like an option in the trial where you can get up and say, okay, you know, of the 17 things you charged me of, this one I'm guilty of, and it's a pretty bad thing. So, but you should really believe me, and the rest of these things aren't, you know, I'm not guilty of the rest of these things. It just doesn't work the way we want it to. And I found a quote from Jenia Turner, who's a professor of constitutional law at SMU, who said, apart from its potential to coerce innocent defendants to plead guilty, the current practice of plea bargaining in the United States is criticized for conflicting with the search for truth. Even if defendants are guilty of some offense, incomplete investigations, inadequate disclosure, limited adversarial training, anyway, you get the idea that for some reason I've lost. Oh, here we go. Where was I at? That even if defendants are guilty of some incomplete investigations, inadequate disclosure, limited adversarial testing, perfunctory judicial oversight, and sizable plea discounts can lead defendants to plead guilty to crimes different from the ones they committed. Some of the same factors can also produce sentences that are disproportionately lenient or disproportionately harsh. They also allow the negotiation of plea bargains that vary based on arbitrary factors such as race, wealth, sex, age, education, intelligence, and confidence.
Yeah. So, Josh, the low-hanging fruit answer to this does seem to be more trials, and yet that seems to be problematic. But in all the reading we did, the very first remedy that is suggested is more courtrooms, more judges, more criminal justice infrastructure.
I know everybody says that, but I feel like that the most obvious answer isn't even, I haven't seen it in anything, but it seems very obvious to me, is that we need to change, as we said during the prosecutors episode, the incentive structures for prosecutors so that they're incentivized to solutions that are not just convictions for misdemeanors and felonies. You know, if we know, for instance, that, you know, one thing that you could maybe plea bargain about is getting involved in treatment for drug addiction, or for mental health treatment, or for some kind of therapy beyond that, cognitive behavioral therapy, or, you know, there's all kinds of incentives that we know from research work better in reforming people. You know, another great example is we've talked about before is restorative justice,
right.
You know, which actually creates an incentive for people to take accountability for what they've done and to try to find healing with the victim of crime, which our current system does nothing to provide. So just changing the incentive structure so that prosecutors think beyond just convictions and putting people in prison,
right,
or getting, you know, certain convictions for felonies or misdemeanors, that they would start to construct better pleas that don't result in terrible outcomes. I think that would be a pretty good starting place.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. So to underline that point, if part of the problem is that 90% or, you know, depending on the context, 90%, 97% of cases end in plea bargain and not trial, that doesn't mean the solution, that we'd have a better system if 90 or 97% went to trial. That's not the ideal if the whole system is pointing towards incarceration or these consequences that don't make society safer, that don't address underlying problems, that don't treat people's health needs, their economic needs, the systematic injustices that create these issues in the first place.
Yeah, there are some other solutions that I've seen that seem interesting to me. I mean, yeah, more trials is, you know, I mean, that, having more involvement by judges, I think, is probably a good thing. Even if you don't have more cases directly go to trial, you could have judges have oversight over the plea bargaining process. Right now, it just happens between a lawyer and the prosecutor, and generally then the plea is brought back to the defendant by the lawyer of the defendant. And so that, in that instance, just having another voice who has a little bit more maybe objectivity and a little less of an incentive to only gain a conviction might help in the process. I think that could be good. I think, you know, some people have suggested that maybe adding a requirement that prosecutors have to justify each additional charge that they would, including providing discovery, which isn't required now, when they make a plea bargain. So in other words, you would provide that you, I would say, here's my offer to you, but I also have to defend all the other things that I'm saying that I'm going to try to charge you with. And so right now they can make it look like all they have serious evidence on all of this stuff and that they're throwing at you. And they can make you terrified that, you know, even if you didn't do it, that they have evidence that you did.
Because right now the plea bargaining process involves no standards of evidence or proof.
Right. Most of the time, they don't have to provide discovery. Yeah. And discovery, if anyone has, you know, if you've forgotten from, that is one thing that they do get correct in a lot of the movies and television shows, is that the prosecutor has to show all the evidence that they have to the defense.
I thought that an idea that we came across that was proposed by John Rappaport, a law professor at the University of Chicago, was very novel and address that issue of the inordinate leverage of the prosecutor. If I could read it from sure. this article in The Atlantic. Quote, if pretrial bargaining with the prosecutor is going to take place, it should embrace more than the basic exchange of guilt for leniency. Defendants should be able to bargain across the trial process itself, offering simplicity in exchange for a lesser charge. What if a defendant agreed to a trial before six or three jurors instead of 12? Or what if the standards of evidence were downgraded from beyond a reasonable doubt to a preponderance of the evidence? In other words, it sounds like what John Rappaport is saying is that the defendant and the defense attorney should have a lot more latitude in approaching the negotiations than just saying the person's guilty or innocent.
Yeah, I think the problem with that is that it doesn't really address the core reason why plea bargains exist, at least from the court standpoint, which is that they don't have enough resources to try them in the first place. So having everyone pick a different kind of trial doesn't necessarily mean they have the space or the judges to have the trials. That could work, I don't know, but that's kind of the way my kind of gut feeling about that one.
Yeah.
Although I did think there, you know, maybe if they had more like bench trials or less, you know, trials under different standards of evidence or things like that, if that was part of the process, that might speed up the process enough to create the difference.
Yeah, I think we read that a municipality that seems to be doing a little better at this is my hometown, Philadelphia, where it seems like they have many more bench trials.
Probably a lot more after the Super Bowl celebration party.
no doubt. But I so agree with you, Josh, and I just appreciate what you said, that it seems like the fundamental or underlying problem is that the prosecutor is rewarded for convictions instead of for making our society safer or for helping people get the support or treatment that they need for the problems that led them to sit before the prosecutor in the first place.
And I think it creates kind of a moral hazard, and I think we'll talk about this a lot over all of our discussions, and that's the idea that we conflate conviction with justice.
Right.
And right now, prosecutors are perversely incentivized to get convictions, even in the face of justice. And you'll see story after story after story. If you do searches just on prosecutorial misconduct, you'll see that they do a lot of stuff that they shouldn't do simply because they're so motivated by this notion that convictions equal justice. And it just isn't true most of the time in my experience.
It also, it sort of ignores that ultimately the goal, and I would think that most people would get behind this, the goal of the justice system should in part be reducing crime itself. This is what's addressed in the Bloomberg article that we read. Reducing crime itself by addressing those underlying social reasons.
Yeah, you would think so.
Yeah. So where does that lead us, Josh?
Well, you know, I mean, I just think that, you know, we've got to find a way to stop making our system about prosecuting as many people as possible and finding a place for them in prisons and jails. And in my opinion, the best way to do that is to stop doubling down on methods that do nothing but produce bad results. And to my mind, the plea bargaining system, which is a huge part of the justice system, produces bad results. So we need to change it, you know, and change the structure so that we're trying to search for healing and justice, not just for punishment at all costs.
Do you think there is room in this process for a different form of agent that can pursue those alternate forms of remedy, those diversions, you know, so that when someone enters the system, a prosecutor isn't their primary counterpart?
Well, I think that there could be supplements to the prosecutor, you know, and I've thought this, you know, I say this, we'll talk about this certainly when we get to jails and prisons too, you know, actually being in jails and prisons, is that, you know, we could really use more direct and less, you know, independent social workers,
right,
and therapists.
That's exactly what I was thinking, is what if when you were, you know, in my imagination, you're sitting in jail, your defense attorney comes to meet with you, and then you go into this room, and on the other side of the table is a prosecutor. What if instead of it being a prosecutor on the other side of the table who is empowered to negotiate and of a fashion adjudicate your destiny, what if it was a social worker who was empowered to do that?
Well, I think, as much as I hate to say this, it would have to be a combination.
Right.
Because the social workers has a different, you know, they serve, all these people serve different purposes. And it is the prosecutor's job to protect the people. I think ultimately the practice of protecting the people has become divorced from the evidence about how best to protect the people. And I think reconnecting those things so that prosecutors are free to take the evidence and not feel like they're going to be punished for applying it and trying to get the best outcome possible, mm-hmm, would really, and the best way for that to happen is to connect prosecutors with social workers and therapists in an environment where they're incentivized to work together instead of an environment in which they're incentivized to ignore each other.
One of the things that I've been thinking about as we've been talking about this, Josh, and I wonder if you know about or could connect this to, are specialty courts. It would seem that specialty courts are an example of people being diverted into a setting where the underlying causes of their of what led them there are taken into account, and where the remedies seem to be more enlightened, informed by a desire for treatment and for mending things.
Yeah, and I know from our experience here in Washtenaw County that getting to the point where there's even diversionary courts has been particularly tough. And again, we're fighting against decades of tough on crime thinking. But it is the same kind of thinking that led to diversionary courts that we're talking about applying here. And that is the notion that, you know, the expertise that needs to be brought to bear is wider than the expertise that we're using.
Right. Well said. Well said. Is there any final words you'd have?
I don't have anything. I mean, what did you learn this week?
So, you know, beginning with the The revelation that we don't have a system that is based on quartz. And you and I were chatting just before we turned on the recorder, and we were discussing how I said that if you imagined a system where all of justice took place outside of the venue of the court, you would recognize that system to be simply Orwellian. And you did a good job of making me aware of what I was saying, which is that that's the system we have now. It is an Orwellian system in which justice takes place, quote unquote.
Justice. Yeah, because you said we have that system, but we technically do have that system. If 97%, if only 3% of all people get to experience the system as you imagine that everybody experiences it, then that is the Orwellian system, not the...
And that I would want that to be the takeaway of anyone who listens to this particular episode, that that our criminal justice system does not happen in the courtrooms we imagine. It happens in these sealed rooms in the bubble of these plea agreements.
Thanks, Joel. As always, good to chat with you about something else.
For sure.
All right, Decarceration Nation is available on iTunes and Stitcher and everywhere else podcasts are aggregated. You can find extensive show notes for every episode on onpiratesatellite.com, which is my blog. I hope everyone's doing great. Talk to you next time.